This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. Today on the program, we have a conversation with Valparaiso Mayor John Costas. He'll tell us why the City Council decided not to take up the issue of the city's $25 annual wheel tax for a vehicle. It's definitely used in Valparaiso to help cover the costs of street and road work. We'll also have as well, too, stories for you from Stephen Lattimore about the new Klein Avenue toll bridge and reaction to the building of that bridge. Sharon Jackson has her feature on food deserts. We'll be bringing you that today as well, too. All coming up. Valparaiso City Council is taking up issues involving motorists in the city, in particular a wheel tax. And for that, we're going to find out the latest from Mayor John Costas. Mayor Costas, thanks for being with us here on Regionally Speaking.
Great to be with you, Chris, here today.
Fill us in what the Common Council is considering, but apparently no action, no vote at least yet. Tell us the status on that.
There's been much movement to try to fill the gap of infrastructure funding for our roads. For years, the amount of money that has been granted local municipalities has been far less than what is necessary to maintain your roads in the proper condition. And the last year, the Indiana legislature created some tools. One of those was a wheel tax to raise more money so that that our roads don't continue to deteriorate. And so last year, our city council, and along with many others, adopted a $25 per year per car fee, and that money is collected and goes directly into road maintenance, and that's a significant development. Now, recently, the legislature has recognized the need for more money and has enacted additional fees, just another, I think, $10 or $15 per year, and increase slightly the gas tax for the purpose of improving roads. And I think this is a significant and long-needed approach, and I'm much in favor of it because when you invest in your infrastructure, it pays off in big ways. So recently, because of what the legislature has done, a few of our council members have suggested if we should take away our original 25 increase per year, our wheel tax. And I don't think there's much support for that because right now everything is so unclear. We have no idea how much this fee is going to raise because it just started in January. Plus, we have no idea how much money we'll receive from the state. So I think the council at this point is at a wait and see. See how much this, and does it get us to the amount we need, which we've determined at this point to be at least $3.6 million. We've been at $2 million, and we think all of these initiatives will get us close to $3.6 million. And here's the concern, Chris. If we don't take care of our roads now, all we're doing is shoving deferred maintenance onto the next generation, to our children, grandchildren, which is unfair. And so that's why we feel very strongly about investing in infrastructure now, and taking good care of it so that when we pass the reins on to the next generation, we pass on a city that is strong and in good shape.
Now, have you and some of the members of the council that have been looking into this have any idea or have talked to people that might have a better projection as to when, if it comes up anytime soon, that you'll be able to take up the issue again of replacing the already enacted wheel tax with this new proposal from the state? But I figure you'll probably get some projection at some time of how much revenue you can generate from the new fee as opposed to the wheel tax.
Yes, I think by the end of the year, we'll have a pretty good understanding. And we've done our estimations, and we feel that we'll probably end up close to $3.6 million we need annually to take care of our roads. So, and if that's the case, then I think we're in great shape and we're doing what we need to do as a community. Let me give you one anecdote. My daughter's a nurse in Indianapolis, and the roads there are not like the roads here. And in this last 2 weeks, she's had to spend about $220 fixing her tires. And then she called me last night saying the new tire also now has a leak in it due to the road. So the point is this: either we take care of our roads or we pay it in maintenance. And it's much better to be proactive, have good roads, and so that we don't pay it in maintenance on our tires and our shocks and those sorts of things. So that's why it's important to be proactive and to invest in infrastructure.
Now, if you do wait until later in the year to enact the changes in the tax, rescind the current wheel tax and put in place the new tax that the General Assembly has put into place, of made available for the city of Valparaiso to use, will you be able to raise the money enough that you need to be able to do what you want to do relatively quickly?
The answer to that, in my estimation, is no. Part of the problem is the wheel tax we raise locally is then used to help access additional funds as part of the state plan, so that if we rescind our tax, we will get less state money and we'll be far, I believe, we'll be far short from what we need to get. So we're in some ways, you know, leveraging the money that we raise locally with state money, and that's the plan they have, and I think that's a good plan. They want us to be invested, and if so, then they will invest with us in it. So I really think it's a great plan that the legislature and the governor put together, because I'm a small business owner for 40 years. I've been mayor here for 14 years, and I've seen that you have to continually invest in either your business, your home, you know, your kids. And when you make that sacrifice and investment, it always pays dividends even beyond what you expected. And that's why I'm a strong believer in running a tight ship. We haven't done a lot of hiring over the last 15 years in the city. We've done more with less. But when it comes to finding money for infrastructure, that's where we want to put our money. And you can see the difference it's made over the last 15 years. Mm-hmm.
So it's worth waiting until the end of the year to reconsider, see what other information you gather in the meantime before you make a decision.
Yeah, and generally speaking, I don't think there's that strong of an effort on the council to rescind it, because they believe in investment. There are some that feel differently on the council, and they've agreed to wait to see what happens. But I just don't anticipate that it's going to be rescinded at all, because it's just a really good idea, and it's really fair to the next generation. So I'm certainly not going to be in support of it unless the projections are much different than what we have estimated.
We're talking with Valparaiso Mayor John Custis. We've had this hot spell, and it's gone at least temporarily, but we know that there'll be a lot more hot weather coming here before autumn comes. And in the meantime, the city of Valparaiso has the cooling centers already. Tell us about these setups and if people need them, where they can go.
Well, it's important. More and more people have air conditioning, and certainly that is a wonderful invention. But there are some that don't, and we just want to make sure that people know that the heat of the day, that, you know, they can, there are places within the city where they can visit and hang out.
We'll have the list, too, on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, to let people know about that.
We're real proud of our downtown. In fact, last year, our Central Park Plaza was named one of the five great public places in America by the American Planning Association, which really is highly unusual for a city our size. The other four winners for last year were very large cities. So it's a special place. There's something happening almost every day there. We have the new Indiana Beverage Center, which is a cooling center. And we have the splash pad, of course, is very popular because it's so convenient to just show up. Some people bring a large umbrella there and just hang out with the kiddos. It's a safe place for them to hang out. And it's just a really neat gathering place where people from all over the city come and interact and have fun. And so a lot happening in downtown. We've improved North Michigan, which has become a really cool area. We have two wine bars that just opened up there, some great restaurants, Mediterranean and Olga's right down there. So that area has added to the downtown. And it's just a lot of activity, a lot of great restaurants and shops and things happening. So we just see people flocking to the city center more and more each day, especially during the summer.
Mayor John Custis, Mayor of Valparaiso, thanks for being with us. Appreciate the comments, and we'll keep back in touch with you to find out some of the latest activities from the city council as well, too.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for this opportunity. Really appreciate it.
Ever since the closure and the demolition of the Klein Avenue Bridge, East Chicago residents lost more than just a shortcut to the casino. They lost a vital transportation link that has affected economic development in the area. But Lakeshore Public Radio's Stephen Lattimore says a new bridge is in the works. He attended a Lakeshore Chamber of Commerce meeting that focused on the project, and he has an update.
According to the builders of the new Klein Avenue Bridge, it'll be a $140 million project. Ed Diffendahl is CEO of United Bridge Partners.
Well, the project will rebuild the Klein Avenue Bridge. We'll pay for the maintenance and construction through a modest toll that will go on the bridge, and we expect to keep that toll as low as possible for the community.
It will be like building a new stadium or convention center. It'll pump millions into the local economy, and local contractors will benefit. East Chicago Mayor Anthony Copeland.
Inside our city, we got a concrete company called Smith Ready Mix, and that company is going to benefit tenfold. Just you see when she talked about the immense amount of concrete that it takes. We got a steel mill, and you see she talked about all the steel rods that they need in this bridge. So the community is going to benefit for it in an economic way, again, like I say, tenfold.
There will also be an impact to local industries. State Senator Lonnie Randolph.
And the most important thing is that when you talk about industry, it's going to aid industry. You're talking about Amoco, Mattel, ArcelorMittal, U.S. Steel, all the major industries in Northwest Indiana. It's going to cut down on their time, transportation costs. It's going to make it much more efficient in delivering the products that they have throughout the entire Midwest, which means what? It's going to make additional funds hopefully coming into the region in terms of economic development, which very well could lead to some increase in jobs. The last 3 years, people have been looking at Indianapolis as the economic engine of the state of Indiana. Hey, for centuries and decades, this has been Northwest Indiana has been the engine that made the state of Indiana go.
State Rep for East Chicago Earl Harris Jr. says the new Klein Avenue Bridge will bring back a vital link that has been missing for so many years.
Anytime you have a bridge go away, there's millions of dollars of impact that has in terms of economics for an area. So the fact that this is a bridge coming back that's going to be built or rebuilt, however that should be phrased, it's going to mean millions of dollars for the area.
Linda Figg of the Figg Bridge Group is the bridge builder. They will prefabricate the sections of the bridge and then lift them into place. They will stockpile the sections in a new building. This will allow them to keep working during the winter.
There will be enough concrete in the bridge that you could build a sidewalk from East Chicago to downtown Chicago and back again. There will be enough steel, reinforcing steel and post-tensioning, to be able to build, I think it's some 4,600 cars. So it's a very robust, redundant, and safe bridge that will serve both very heavy trucks, or really any kind of load that you wouldn't want to put on the bridge, and large volumes of traffic. The toll will be in the 2.25 to 2.50 range. You will be able to use an electronic transponder, the same transponders that you can use for the iPad. It actually goes beyond Riley Road and connects into the state highway that's existing there now. So, it kind of goes beyond those boundaries. And then we're picking up on one end of the bridge, there's a steel structure, a steel bridge that's there, and we're rehabilitating that so it goes much further on the east as well. It's much more than getting to the casino. But that's not bad either.
They hope to have the project completed in 30 months.
Stephen had a chance after the Lakeshore Chamber of Commerce meeting to talk with some residents in the area and motorists as well. They're happy about this new road with the new bridge, but they are not happy about having to pay a toll.
The new Klein Avenue Bridge will cost the taxpayer nothing. The bridge will be a toll road and will cost $2.25 per visit. 10 cents of every toll will go back to the city of East Chicago to pay for infrastructure. Motorists we talked to say they are excited.
I think it's good. I mean, hopefully it'll take some traffic off of the East Chicago roads, Whiting roads. I grew up in Whiting, so anytime we can see less traffic over on Indianapolis Boulevard there, it's a plus.
I think it's a positive thing because it needs to be done. It should have been done a long time ago.
But while they are happy about the return of the road that will take them to State Road 912, they are really upset about the fact that it is a toll road.
It'd be $2.25. What do you think about that?
I think that's kind of expensive, but hey, it's an easier route.
How do you feel about the idea of a toll road?
I don't like it. It's a small stretch of road, so I would rather see it be free.
You don't like the idea of a toll road?
No, not at all. I mean, I don't think we should have to pay. I don't.
If all goes as planned, the new Klein Avenue Bridge will debut in 2019. In East Chicago, Stephen Lattimore, Lakeshore Public Radio.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Hoosier lawmakers are expected to address the issue of food deserts here in Indiana in the upcoming 2018 session. Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson has more about the issue of food deserts and how difficult it is for some people to get to a supermarket.
State Representative Charlie Brown is working toward putting an end to food deserts in Indiana.
And I am in the process of writing a letter to Jewel Osco and says, why not Gary, Indiana? I'm in the process of sending a letter to CVS saying, fill that void being left by Walgreens. You know, you can make money off of the city of Gary by locating a store within the corporate limits of Gary.
The American Nutrition Association defines a food desert as an urban area in which it is difficult to buy affordable or good quality fresh food. This is largely due to a lack of grocery stores, farmers markets, and healthy food providers, and food deserts are usually found in impoverished areas. Brown, who represents District 3, which covers Gary, says a major portion of his district is in a food desert.
It's so unfair and unfortunate that Gary is just dumped on an ongoing basis that yes, people here, be they school teachers, be they doctors, be they just plain ordinary workers in the steel mills or whatever, they are inconvenienced by having to get what their needs, be they pharmaceuticals, be they clothing, be they groceries, have to go outside of the corporate limits of Gary to make those purchases.
And many people who live in impoverished areas not only make very little money, but many don't have a car, and they can live anywhere from a mile or more from the closest grocery store. Gary resident Lorraine Lewis doesn't have a vehicle. The proximity between her residence and the local grocery store costs her about 1 hour of her time just to make a trip to the market.
How close is that to your house?
Maybe a bus ride. Just one bus.
How long is the bus ride?
Well, two buses now. Because I moved on 53rd. But when I stayed on 35th, it was just one bus.
How long of a trip is that for you?
When I was on 35th, it may be about 20-minute ride.
And now you're on 53rd. How long is the trip?
Oh, that's two. It's two bus rides. It's about an hour. But, you know, you do what you do. You know, you do what you got to do to survive.
And now, with the closing of many Strack and Van Til properties in Northwest Indiana, it makes the situation even more challenging. What impact is that going to have on...
Well, it just compounds the situation because now I think that a couple of the stores that they are planning to close will be converted to a Jewel Osco. But nonetheless, that's still, those will be outside of corporate limits of Gary.
Brown says he hasn't spoken to corporate leaders about why they don't locate their store in Gary, but he has spoken to lobbyists.
They come to me and ask for my vote to make it more convenient for them revenue-wise or store-wise. And I say, why then don't you open a store in my district, within my city? And the answer is always, the surveys that we do indicate that that would not be profitable to us. Well, everything isn't on your bottom line. It's a matter of providing services to people that need those services. And so I am taking the posture that don't come to me, large box stores, don't come to me asking me to support an endeavor of yours in the Indiana General Assembly if you are turning your back on my community.
Charles Jones, who is originally from Gary but now lives in Merrillville, remembers what it was like when he lived a far distance from the closest grocery store.
Where I used to live on 11th, and the closest one there is all the way on Grant. So that's pretty far. That's about a good 10-15 minute drive.
How many miles do you think that is?
That is probably maybe about
15 miles?
Yeah, about just about, almost. Usually, if you want certain foods or anything like that, you have to go into Merrillville because that grocery that's down here on Grant doesn't have a lot of it. But, I mean, it all depends on what you're looking for. And then if you need groceries, you got to go to the grocery store. So it's out the way because it's all the way on the other side of town. But at the same time, I mean, you got to do what you got
to
do.
We need to rattle that chain, that saver, and say, no more will I come and spend my dollars with you if you won't come into the corporate limits of Gary. There's no reason why there should not and could not be a store right at Route 20 and Route 51, State Road 51. That large, right off of the expressway, that even those that are outside of the corporate limits of Gary could have easy access to stores there.
Brown says the Senate will study the food desert issue in September and October, and there will be proposals made during the 2018 legislative session.
More than likely, legislation, the summer study committees will gear up sometime late August or September, in which the issue of food deserts will be studied, and then there will be proposals for legislation to correct those incidences across the state where many people do not have access to fresh foods. Hopefully, we will have one, two, maybe three pieces of legislation dealing with that matter.
A solution would help a lot of people, people like Lorraine, who Lakeshore Public Radio spoke to. She was forced to end our conversation because she had to run for the bus with shopping bags in hand.
You know, you do what you got to do to survive.
Hey!
Hey! You got to go.
Oh, sorry. Bye-bye. Thank you. All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. Hold on.
If she misses that, we'll have to take her. Okay, good. She made it on the bus.
We can head back now then. For Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Sharon Jackson.
President Trump's 2018 budget is seen as a big setback for the Great Lakes. It eliminates $300 million from a restoration fund, and it cuts spending for key agencies. In this series coming up, we travel around the Five Lakes for some projects that are being threatened. And we begin with the folks with the Great Lakes today at the headwaters of Lake Superior.
100 years ago, U.S. Steel built a massive mill along the banks of the St. Louis River, about 10 miles southwest of downtown Duluth. For decades, the plant provided great jobs. But along with logging mills and other industry that once lined the river, it also left behind a long legacy of pollution.
And they pumped all their sludge and stuff from the coke ovens just up here. I'll show you.
Rob Moss steers his fishing boat upriver to the site of the old Duluth Works, where he worked a half century ago making barbed wire that was shipped to Vietnam. He raised his kids just blocks from the river.
I used to come down here and fish with them off the point and stuff here just to catch fish. But you couldn't, you'd take them home if you cooked them, you'd all stunk. You know, they just smelled terrible. You could tell they weren't healthy or clean.
Since then, the river has made a remarkable comeback. Water quality improved tremendously in the 1980s after a sewage treatment plant went online. Moss, who's 71 now and retired, fishes the river more than 200 days a year. He's even able to eat much of what he catches. But toxic contaminants still remain trapped in the river sediment.
And so this whole delta area is contaminated sediment.
Mike Bars with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency points out where the steel mill once stood. One of the byproducts of steelmaking was coal tar, which washed into the river.
And it's up to 17 feet thick in some places.
Of sediment?
Of contaminated sediment.
Altogether, there's enough contaminated muck to fill more than 800 Olympic-sized swimming pools.
It's really hard to see contamination that's under the water, but this is what it's all about. It's in the aquatic ecosystem, and it really is causing some major issues.
Barr says the pollution kills microscopic critters living in that muck that form the base of the food chain. Clean that up, and all the bigger fish and wildlife can thrive. That prospect has Rob Moss excited.
I use it. I use it every day. I have people that come and fish with me from California, Las Vegas, Florida, all over the country, and they can't believe when you're out here, you don't even know you're by a city. It's just phenomenal.
It's taken several years, but state regulators, the EPA, and U.S. Steel have finalized a plan to clean up the sediment. It calls for the EPA to cover a little over half the $69 million price tag, with U.S. Steel picking up the rest. But now the cleanup work is in jeopardy. President Trump's proposed budget to Congress calls for cutting the $300 million Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. Dredging and capping the U.S. steel pollution is just one part of a broader plan to clean up the entire St. Louis River estuary by 2020. Nelson French of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency says the plan has been 30 years in the making, but relies on federal dollars to leverage state and private funding.
And we're just at the juncture where the feasibility studies have been done, the designs are about to start,
and we now have this uncertainty thrown at us.
The EPA says if funding comes through, work on the U.S. Steel project is scheduled to begin next fall. And the city of Duluth is banking on it. It has ambitious plans to revitalize the riverfront to spark neighborhood and economic development. Director of Public Administration Jim Philby Williams says that's dependent on the river first getting cleaned up.
The foundation of all we hope to achieve for our community along the river is completed restoration of the river.
A restoration that's now in doubt. This is Dan Crocker of Minnesota Public Radio reporting for Great Lakes Today.
And our series continues tomorrow with a look at efforts to keep Asian carp out of Lake Michigan. Great Lakes Today is a collaboration of public radio stations WBFO Buffalo, IdeaStream Cleveland, and WXXI in Rochester, New York. And for more stories, you can go to the website greatlakestoday.org. A 2017 survey from T. Rowe Price shows, in looking at the parent attitudes and the behaviors associated with the youngsters' financial habits, and found in the survey that some positive money behaviors that the parents have made can lead to the children having some good financial habits as well. Let's check into the survey and get some ideas as well for handling finances, especially if you're a parent and wanting to help your youngsters learn some things that maybe you have learned along the way and improve on that learning. We have Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer with us. Hi, Greg. Thanks for joining us here in Ridgely Speaking.
Thanks, Chris. How are you doing today?
I'm fine. But let's talk first here about spending too much money. It's very difficult to do, follow us what I tell you here and not have a good example to follow.
Yeah, and I think just to kind of start off with what you mentioned, it's amazing how much I think kids can absorb from their parents without even realizing it. You know, the example that they said, I know even with my parents, you know, one of the things that I don't ever recall my parents using credit cards. In fact, it was kind of convincing them to get one when it was necessary for buying. So it really set a principle about purchasing that you spent what you could afford to buy. And the temptation of going to credit wasn't there because that's not the way it functioned, but it ingrained and instilled a good principle for me.
Well, I remember the very first credit card that my dad ever had and even told me about was a Diners Club card. That tells you how long ago it's been. But that was a card that he very seldom, if ever, used unless he had to do something for business. And he kept it like that. He did his best to not have to rely on credit unless it was something big like a car or like a house.
Right, exactly. And that was a lot of the things that, you know, even growing up, you know, resonated with me, and I actually went the wrong way for a little bit and realized how bad it made me feel when I started using credit cards, not realizing it. And then, you know, when I looked at back what my parents did and how they survived on the income that they did, it made me realize that I really need to consider a different approach than utilizing credit.
One of the other areas I know that's always talked about is taking advantage of the technology that we have available to us here. How important is that in trying to teach your youngsters or anybody teaching anybody else, for that matter, how to properly use money?
Well, I think it's critical because if you don't automate to a degree what you're doing for retirement or automate to a degree what you're trying to do in strategies when it comes to paying off debt, it's just very cumbersome, and generally you don't do it. I mean, willpower is simple. I know how most people are. It's the same way I am. If I have money in my pocket, I generally spend it. But if I use automated programs like 401ks or direct savings automatically from my paycheck, what you find is it's a very effective process, and accounts grow.
One of the other things I know that we've talked about here before in dealing with credit is paying off that credit and to do it as wisely as you possibly can. And I know that this, of course, comes back down to the old adage that, you know, that you only need to make the minimum payment. Well, that's not really a very good idea, is it?
Right. It's probably the worst leveraging possible, especially in the environment we're in right now. I think a lot of folks are concerned because they've used credit lines that are very low rates right now. Credit cards that are low relative to what I believe they'll be in the next few years here as interest rates start to rise. So that minimum is going to become more expensive, and the minimum is really just paying the financing. And when you're paying at those higher rates, it's a very difficult hole to dig out of.
In our past conversations, Greg Hammer, we have talked to you about the importance of saving for retirement, and that just goes not only from our own experiences, but also the ones we can teach our youngsters.
Yeah, I think the easiest principle to me, sooner the better. Time is always your your best advocate, your best partner, the most you'll ever gain from a retirement plan. And I tell folks before you sit and have a conversation with me as an advisor, if you have a program through work like a 401k, especially if they're matching dollars, it goes back to that automated thing we were just chatting about, take advantage of those matching dollars. There's nothing that's going to compare to it. And when it's coming directly from the source before you get the funds, you're going to stay consistent in your plan.
One of the things that is brought up, and maybe it's maybe trying to get a definition to a term here that I have seen lately, is lifestyle creep. What is that, and how important is it to be sure that that doesn't happen?
Yeah, lifestyle creep is associated with either advances in jobs or incomes. A lot of folks are paid on bonus, where as the income goes up, people generally tend to spend more of that money, and that goes back to the discipline and automation of saving. Because a lot of people, especially to take a bonus, for example, you get a bonus, they feel like, hey, this is something that is extra for me. I've earned extra, and it is. But they'll use that geared towards something that's completely fun as opposed to saying, hey, let's take part of it, pay down some debt, or let's take part of it and put it away. It becomes more of an asset that they tend to exhaust. And as your income goes up, generally people try to spend more. I mean, think about houses for a second, Chris. I mean, most people go in, and when they go to buy a house, it's always about, you know, what my income will allow me to buy and not necessarily about what I can afford to buy, you know, or afford to pay for.
Well, it's also important, too, to take advantage of the opportunity that if you can put as much down as a down payment, of a down payment down, that it's worth going ahead and spending that extra money for that.
Oh, absolutely. And even to the point of when you talk about, you know, get into the fees and interest rates and simple things you can approach. I mean, if you look at a 15 or 20-year financing on a home as opposed to a 30, you can get a better finance rate. Things are going to be paid off sooner. And, you know, so many people say it's the convenience of your credit cards for the points. But essentially, you're getting those points, but you are paying more. There's fees associated with that if you're not paying those credit cards off every month. You know, so you just got to be cognitive of that and don't pay for something that you don't have to. A lot of fees are voluntary, like cash versus credit type situations. And even to the point where, you know, you'll use a different ATM machine that could allow you to get it free at your bank versus not planning and using it, you know, so at a different location because it was more convenient.
We talked about dealing with money. Let's talk about something that for many people requires having to spend a little money, but it's supposed to have some benefit with hope in the future, and that's having insurance and having enough insurance. It's very important not to be underinsured.
Absolutely. I think it's people don't realize how important of a planning tool it is, and it comes in a lot of different forms. I mean, especially disability. I mean, people talk about, you know, I'm good, you know, nothing's going to happen to me, I'm not going to pay for life insurance as an example, which still is, you know, is critical in my eyes. But a lot of people don't realize losing their earning power is a very high potential, even losing it for a short amount of time, 6 months, a year, you know, something that lays you up. That particular gap could set people back financially and create a debt situation that's very difficult to climb out of. But a lot of times when you work hard to, you know, build these assets, you need to protect them. You know, having good health insurance, having possible things that would cover long-term care stays so that the surviving spouse would still have those assets. But even the insurance, I mean, being able to, insurance is a lot of times a need until you get to where, you know, you are for what most people would consider self-insured.
Mm-hmm. Well, Greg Hammer, we've talked about a lot of great things here that are certainly good advice. And I suppose if we followed at least a few of them, then we might be able to say that we've probably set a good legacy for ourselves off to our families. Would you think?
Absolutely. And I think just the final point that I would emphasize, I had great examples of my parents. And if you have children, you know, just consider the impact that you're making on them in terms of the actions that you take and the things that you do.
That's Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer. When a person overdoses on opioids, the hospital staff typically revives them with an overdose antidote and sends them on their way. Those same patients oftentimes land back in the hospital again after another overdose. Now, emergency services across the country are trying something new. They're hiring former addicts to connect those patients with the support they need to get their treatment for addiction. And Side Effects Public Media reporter Esther Honig met with a community health worker, a man in recovery from his own addiction, doing this sort of work in Columbus, Ohio.
Charlie Stewart is tall, 25 years old, and has broad shoulders. He wears a gray polo shirt and slacks and starts each morning with a protein shake. Every Tuesday, you can find him here, walking the narrow linoleum halls of the emergency department at Mount Carmel West.
So what's maybe one of the first things you do when you get here in the morning?
I usually set up, I get on and look at people's charts and find out if there are any overdoses or anyone with addiction-related, you know, services that they need here.
Stewart says when he meets a new patient, he's listening for something specific.
I don't want to put any words in anyone's mouth. I don't want to give them any ideas. I want them to have an idea like, hey, I'm thinking about getting clean. I'm thinking about going to detox. And then it's like, I can help you do that.
Stewart works with doctors and nurses, but he's not in this position because he has a degree in medicine or social work. He's trained to work with patients as a peer mentor, but he also has a past of drug addiction.
It was really started pretty young. I mean, drinking, using, partying a little too much.
Stewart says he abused a number of drugs, including opiates. Now that he's been in recovery for a number of years, he's become a powerful ally to the medical staff here. They can treat addicts with life-saving drugs, but Stewart has walked in their shoes.
I've lived it, and I know the struggle, and I see these people, and it's not that they're, you know, they don't have a moral deficiency or anything like that. They're just sick and they need help.
Before Stewart began working here, it was hard for staff to make a personal connection with someone struggling with an opiate addiction. Brian Pearson with Mount Carmel says staff would see the same patients overdosing again and again, and doctors could do little more than offer them naloxone, a drug for reversing an overdose.
They would be discharged. Either they would be discharged because there's nothing more that we could do for them, or they would be discharged because they've decided that they're going to leave and there's nothing we can do to keep them there. We can't force them to stay.
Now it's Stewart's job to put these patients in touch with detox centers or long-term treatment facilities, as well as other resources like food stamps, housing, and transportation. This position builds on a model commonly known as the community health worker. Because Stewart understands addiction, he can act as a liaison between his peers and the healthcare system. Pearson says that's exactly what happened when Stewart first came to interview for the position. He heard a patient had come in with an abscess on their neck.
And Charlie made the recommendation, hey, you know, that's commonly seen in somebody who's suffering from opiate use disorders.
The nurse went back, and after another assessment, it turned out Stewart was right.
Having Charlie in that space at that time helped identify something that might not have been identified otherwise.
And he says Stewart offers more than his insight. He's a living example of success.
He tells a story of hope. This is not a character flaw. There is hope. If I go through treatment, I can be successful. I can recover, and I can look and sound like Charlie, who's standing in front of me right now, telling his story in a really powerful way.
So far, this program has been running for 4 months and has helped 10 people enter into long-term addiction treatment. Esther Honig, Side Effects Public Media.
This is Originally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Indiana health insurers will have time to file their 2018 tax their rates this week for the Affordable Care Act marketplace. And Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan tells us that uncertainty about the future of healthcare reform may play into price and availability for about 150,000 Hoosiers who are in the system.
Indiana has four insurers on the ACA's individual marketplace. This year, average rates for Hoosiers are slightly lower than 2016, but insurance companies seem most worried about the future of cost-sharing subsidies as they consider their 2018 rates. The subsidies are $7 billion a year to help offset the cost of plans insurers offer to low-income Americans. Former Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS, head Andy Slavitt cites a number of letters to Indiana Democratic U.S. Senator Joe Donnelly from insurers worried about the future.
Rushing to repeal the bill, actively undermining the insurance markets, resulting in very large proposed increases in 2018 relative to what they would otherwise be.
Another concern is providers leaving the market. Indianapolis-based Anthem announced this month it will leave the Ohio marketplace. And current CMS Chief Seema Verma says her agency predicts more insurers dropping out. She calls it a, quote, failing report card for the exchanges. At the same time, insurer Centene announced plans to expand in Indiana. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
The amount of timber that loggers harvest from state forests continues to increase, averaging about 14 million board feet per year over the past 5 years. The increase has environmental activists concerned, but the state maintains it's just good forestry management. And as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Becca Costello reports, both sides are backing up their position with science.
I'm going to admit it. I hug my trees.
because they're still there.
That's Julie James. She manages a small organic farm in rural Monroe County with an orchard, rows of berry bushes, and a greenhouse. Standing on her porch, she can almost see Yellowwood State Forest. Being so close to Yellowwood is one of the primary reasons she moved here 8 years ago. Every day, rain or shine, she hikes the trails with her dogs.
I thought, I've definitely arrived. This is absolute paradise. I'm in a state forest, and state forests are protected, right? So it'll always be this way. I really did naively think that.
But 3 years ago, big equipment started rolling in on her small road. The Indiana Division of Forestry started logging tracts of land. That year, in 2014, Indiana logged more than 17 million board feet from the state forests. That's a 391% increase since 2003. The rate of logging started to increase the year Jack Seifert took over as head of the forestry division.
What we do is we go in and just thin it down, get it down to...
As Seifert walks through Morgan Monroe State Forest, he sees healthy stands of trees. He says logging is a management tool to keep the forest healthy by removing dying trees to let young saplings grow in their place.
Our goal has always been to make sure the forest is healthy, and that's obviously derived by whose definition a healthy forest is. Our definition of a healthy forest is to maintain a pretty diverse species group as well as a diverse age group.
Groups like the Indiana Forest Alliance agree with that definition, but only to a certain point.
Well, first of all, a healthy forest involves trees of all ages, including dead trees. A healthy forest ecosystem would include quite a few dead trees.
That's Ray Schnapp, the conservation director for the IFA. Her background is in soil science, and every year she leads a team of scientists inventorying the species diversity here in Morgan Monroe State Forest. Schnapp says continuing timber harvest at the current rate will be devastating.
And the way that the DNR, the Division of Forestry, is managing our forests is primarily for timber production. So their idea of a healthy forest is one that is producing a healthy economic income for the agency. They're not managing for ecosystem health. They're not managing for the species that are most endangered that require deep interior forests for their survival.
A bill introduced in the state legislature this year asked for 10% of forests to be set aside as old growth. That means no logging can take place there, no matter what. That bill didn't make it out of committee. In its most recent strategic plan, the Division of Forestry does say it will work toward a long-term goal of preserving 10% of forest acreage in older forest conditions, but it hasn't said which areas are protected.
And so we're just trying to kind of hold their feet to the fire to make sure that we do get 10% of our forest set aside.
Seifert says he recognizes that a lot of Hoosiers aren't happy with the way the forests are being managed, and he's taken steps to try to restore some trust. Every year, representatives from two independent agencies do inspections on Indiana State Forest properties and publish their findings. And every year since 2006, the state has received high marks. University of Kentucky professor Jeff Stringer helped establish the standards for one of those auditing agencies, the National Forest Stewardship Council, or FSC.
The fact that the Indiana State Forest have reached out, under their own volition and get certified under FSC, I think that's positive. Certainly a lot of states don't have that, because at least it indicates to the public, and those who are concerned about it, what kind of practices are being used there.
But Stringer grants that auditing firms like the FSC assume that at least some logging will take place, and some environmental critics want a complete ban on timber production on public lands. The Indiana Forest Alliance doesn't go that far. They aren't opposed to logging entirely, but they do want to see less of it. But Seifert says the criticism is still unfounded. For Julie James, the issue is personal. The area of Yellowwood near her small farm has changed so much, she's even considering moving away from the paradise she thought she had found.
Can I stay and deal with this? Or if they're going to keep logging like this, is that something I want to be around year after year and take these hikes and fewer trees are there?
James says she'll continue contacting her lawmakers to advocate for changes to timber production in Indiana's public forests. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Becca Costello.
On this Monday, here's John Kane with South Shore Arts with Eye on the Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Jean Bargerin, a very well-known and established artist with a stellar reputation.
Thank you.
In our region. You have been living in the dunes for many years.
I live in Ogden Dunes. I've been there 21 years.
And you have just been painting your heart out.
I have. You've said it. I've just been painting. I paint every single day. I do portraits and landscapes. And I've hooked up with the DPAP, that's Duneland Plein Air Painters, 3 years ago. Uh-huh. And, and it's just been a grand, grand experience.
Were you always an artist, Jean?
No, I've had six careers. Mm-hmm. Art has always been a part of it. Mm-hmm. I was actually in advertising, had my own agency, and did all of the art to do with that. Mm-hmm.
And did you always live in the Dunes?
No,
area?
I'm from the East Coast, actually.
Okay. I didn't know that.
I'm a transplant because of the steel industry. Mm-hmm. And when my husband retired, we decided we loved Ogden Dunes, we loved the community, and mm-hmm. we were tired of moving. Mm-hmm. We moved six times, six different states. It gets old.
Yeah, sure.
So here I am, and I'm a Hoosier. Well, and glad to be.
That's good. I've been aware of your artwork, and I truly admire your artwork a great deal. It's quite beautiful.
And thank you.
Yes, I think you're a very fine artist.
Thank you. I've spent actually the last 2 years working with Virginia Phillips, mm-hmm. and she has. I helped her collaborate on a couple of paintings as her illness progressed. Mm-hmm. And I have learned so much about color mm-hmm. and dynamic approach to real things. Mm-hmm. She just was marvelous.
You have you're the Duneland Plein Air Painters mm-hmm. are the group you're affiliated with. They're going to have an exhibit at the Brouwer Museum at Valparaiso University.
Right. The opening will be May 21st. Mm-hmm. It will extend to August 7th.
So this is a nice long show for you all through
the summer. It's lovely. It's lovely. And it's really a nice representation of the kind of work that plein air artists do. Should be sweet and lovely.
Do you, as a group, do you get together on a frequent
once a week.
Basis? Once a week.
Once a week. We can meet during the winter months. We don't paint outdoors, but we meet frequently at the Art Barn. At mm-hmm. their open paint mm-hmm. times during the winter. Mm-hmm. When the weather turns, that's when our season actually begins, mm-hmm. When we can stand, our digits can stand the cold, and the paint doesn't freeze.
Do you wear those gloves that have little holes where the fingers go?
I do.
You do?
I'm the only one.
Are you really?
I am, yeah.
Those always remind me of Dickens.
Yes, yes, yes,
Oliver
indeed.
Oliver Twist.
But we artists come and paint with us. Our membership extends from all three counties, mm-hmm. So it would be Porter and Lake and LaPorte. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we're not afraid to drive. We go all over 2 hours to the destination. Mm-hmm. Our painting subjects can go anywhere from a beautiful floral situation in someone's garden mm-hmm. To industrial painting, which takes some organization, but we have a lot of interest in it. Hmm. Yeah,
that's
it's
great.
A different dynamic.
It is. I love paintings of industry. I think they're so fascinating.
Yeah.
So how many artists will be involved in the exhibit at the Brouwer?
I believe there's about 10.
Okay.
Yeah.
Everybody's excited about it, I'm sure.
Yes.
It's such a beautiful
venue. This is art showing season. Mm-hmm. There are many shows going on at the same time. So artists have to decide how they're going to divide up their work mm-hmm. and where they're going to go. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, that's great. Yeah. I would like to extend an invitation to your group to exhibit at South Shore Arts sometime.
Well, thank you.
That would be a great thing for us as well.
Thank you. Well, so, I certainly will pass that on.
Oh,
and I know we'll say yes.
Okay.
I can speak with no authority, but I believe it's true.
Well, I think we should talk about that.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, good luck with your show.
Thank you.
And I'm sure that many people will enjoy it this summer. And sounds like the perfect thing for the season.
Yes. You know, the Brouwer is not that easy to find, so I would like to mention the address, if you wouldn't mind.
Sure.
It is 1709 Chapel Drive. In Valparaiso, at the University of Valparaiso. And visually, you can see the big chapel. Mm-hmm. And then catty corner to it is the Brouwer Museum. It's not very well marked. So beware, it's worth the trip. Mm-hmm. The show is going to be wonderful. Mm-hmm. And we thank Greg Hertzlieb and Gloria Roof for putting up with us and giving us the Ferguson room.
Yeah, great.
Yeah.
And it's right next to the Harari Student Union building.
Okay.
Where the Brower is, yeah. Okay. All right, Jean. Thank you for being here to tell us about the show.
Good to see you again, John.
And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
Thank you very much, John. You can hear this conversation with Jean Bargeron and other Eye on the Arts conversations on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. That's it for today's Regionally Speaking. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for being with us. Tomorrow on the program, a conversation with South Shore CVA Chief Sparrow Spottistatos. We hope you'll join us for that.